Most of us know someone who's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but some aspects of the disease, even for those who are familiar with it, can seem mysterious and frightening. Today on Please Explain, we'll talk to two eminent experts in the field of Alzheimer's research. Dr. Richard Mayhew is the Gertrude H. Sojewski Professor of Neurology, Psychiatry, and Epidemiology, and the co-director of the Taub Institute of Research on Alzheimer's Disease and the Aging Brain at Columbia University Medical College. And Dr. Samuel Gandy is a professor of neurology and psychiatry and the associate director of the Mount Sinai Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, chair of the National Medical and Scientific Advisory Council of the Alzheimer's Association. Very pleased to welcome the two of them to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
And Dr. Mayhew, is there a clear definition of Alzheimer's disease?
Oh, yes. There's a set of criteria. They've been in place for almost 20, 25 years. Everyone has agreed on these criteria for the clinical diagnosis, and they're fairly reliable.
Well, when it was first identified as a disease, what led somebody to think that this was different from other forms of dementia?
Well, I think initially
that was 1901.
Yes, 1901. A group of pathologists in France were working on separating dementia in a very young woman from what was then known as dementia praecox, schizophrenia, and they performed an autopsy, and there were new silver stains available, and they could see changes in the brain that they hadn't seen in the other diseases. And for almost a decade, or actually for several decades, people thought of Alzheimer's disease as only a disease of young people.
But talking about autopsies, I've heard that even now you can't be 100% sure that somebody had Alzheimer's unless you do an autopsy.
Well, that is debatable, I guess. We can be fairly reasonable. Even a good general internist can be fairly accurate. There have been studies showing that, you know, 90% of the time they're correct. Now, when they're not correct, it's not because the person's normal. It's because the person has another related degenerative disease.
So, Dr. Gandy, what are the cardinal symptoms?
Well, obviously the most famous symptom or sign of Alzheimer's is the inability to form and retrieve new short-term memories. But as the disease progresses, essentially all thinking function is abolished. All ability to orient oneself in space, to navigate in space, and eventually the cortex is destroyed and people die in what's called a vegetative state.
I've read that 1 in 10 senior citizens will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, which seems like an extraordinarily high number. Has it been on the rise, or did we misdiagnose it in too many cases before?
Well, as Dr. Mayhew said in its initial description, it was attributed only as a disease of middle-aged people. It was only really in the 70s when some scientists working at Albert Einstein recognized that the pathology and the clinical symptoms of what had been thought of as Alzheimer's presenile dementia was indistinguishable from what we've been calling senility, lo these many decades. And at that point, it became clear that there was a continuum of disease and that most senility was, in fact, pathological and was Alzheimer's disease.
But is it on the rise because people are living longer?
Certainly, the prevalence or the number of cases, I should say, is on the rise, and especially with the aging of the baby boom, this is really an economic catastrophe because we are currently unable to importantly delay or prevent the disease, and aging of the baby boom will really itself, just Alzheimer's disease, will consume the entire Medicare budget by 2050.
Dr. Mayhew, if I suspected that someone might have Alzheimer's, what's the process of diagnosis? What happens first?
Well, generally speaking, a good memory examination and neurological examination, there are some treatable disorders, depression, low thyroid, things like that, that can mimic Alzheimer's disease. But most of the time, general internists can exclude those diagnoses, and the neurological diagnosis is based on demonstrating that there's memory loss, as Dr. Gandy mentioned.
Would you also look for a genetic component?
Well, you don't always do that. The late-onset form of Alzheimer's disease tends to aggregate in families, and there's been a great deal of effort, both through the Alzheimer's Association and the National Institute on Aging and of the National Institutes of Health, to identify all of the genes that are predisposing people to late-onset or senile types of Alzheimer's disease. And there are a few candidates around, and the idea there would be to identify genes that encode proteins, and these proteins may have the clue to the cause.
Although nobody is suggesting that it's cooking with aluminum pots and pans as they did at one point.
Well, no one's. There's been a great deal of effort trying to identify some environmental factors, but none of them have been sort of able to be consistently related to the disease.
So what's happening neurologically as the disease progresses?
Well, the first thing is Sam mentioned is that the disease really starts in the part of the brain that forms memories. And probably it starts decades before, years before people even become aware that they have a problem. So not always is it that when you forget where your car keys are, does that mean you're getting Alzheimer's disease? But it's when your memory, your short-term memory, is more than the average, impairment. So people oftentimes aren't even aware that they're having memory problems. Their spouse or a loved one points it out to them.
My guests are Dr. Richard Mayhew of Columbia University Medical College and Dr. Samuel Gandy of Mount Sinai School of Medicine. We're talking about Alzheimer's. In a little while, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Dr. Gandy, why is it that some people become agitated and angry and others seem to become more docile?
Well, that apparently is attributable to which parts of the brain are involved at any one point. Because the entire brain will degenerate. It degenerates in different regions, in different rates, in different people. And especially as the frontal cortex changes, that tends to be responsible for personality and may disinhibit people and cause them to be agitated or develop inappropriate behavior or may make them depressed and withdrawn.
What does it mean when people say that there are tangles in the brain?
So the pathology of Alzheimer's involves a couple of fairly well-characterized steps. The first is that there's degeneration of the nerve cells that create a chemical called acetylcholine, which is a substance known as a neurotransmitter. Nerve cells use them to talk to each other. As those nerve cells die, the acetylcholine levels go down. And the medicines that are currently available help the brain to compensate for that deficiency. But the tangles are part of what we call the protein pathology. The brain and the body is composed of three main types of substances: sugars, fats, and proteins. And these are proteins that accumulate inside nerve cells. There are also other proteins that accumulate, that clump and form structures called plaques in between nerve cells. And in some of the rare genetic forms of the disease, we know that the mistakes in those genes for those plaque proteins are where the disease begins.
Isn't that where you and your team did a lot of research, looking into ways of lowering the formation of amyloid plaques in the late 1980s?
Well, yes, that's right, and we still do that to this day. The rare genetic forms of Alzheimer's disease, some of the genes that Richard and his team have implicated, all tend to point to amyloid as at least one way that Alzheimer's can begin. And so it's fair to say that in the only cases of Alzheimer's disease that we fully understand, those cases, albeit rare, begin with mistakes in genes for amyloid or substances that control amyloid metabolism. though 99% of the time we can't find those mistakes. Then that's really the challenge. One model for the disease is that all forms have a single final common pathway which leads to amyloid. That then builds up in clumps and poisons nerve cells.
Dr. Mayu, I understand that you and your team look for biological markers that are present to people with Alzheimer's. And you're trying to find them in blood, so you just can do a simple blood workup and discover whether somebody has it or is about to have it?
Well, that would be the best case scenario. I mean, we're trying. I wouldn't say that we've definitively identified one, but the idea would be to try to find something that in the blood, equivalent to something like a cholesterol, that would be something we can identify that would indicate that a person's on the at higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. The goal there would be then to use that as a marker so that one could start treatment before you develop symptoms.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. And our first call is from Catherine from Stamford. Hi, Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, how would you suggest approaching someone who has denial about their memory loss or confusion, and what test or tests would you recommend that they have if you could get them to even consent?
Do you want to start, Dr. Mayu?
Sure. This is always a difficult problem, and the best thing that I can suggest is to have whoever's closest to this individual accompany them at the doctor's office. We usually try to say that we're trying to do an evaluation of their memory and also the person who's their companion. And after a while, they can become more comfortable with the doctor, and often they can then proceed to give them some memory tests to see if they even have memory loss. Once you establish that rapport, it's much easier to try to do tests.
But there is a strong denial problem.
There is.
Not
in
everyone. Well, good luck, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
We have another Elizabeth calling, by the way. Elizabeth from Pleasantville. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My question is, I'll take the answer off the air. My mom had Alzheimer's. Does that mean I have a higher chance of getting it too?
Well, your risk is certainly higher than the average, but we're all at risk. By virtue of living into our 80s and 90s, we all carry some degree of risk. By virtue of having one family member, an immediate family member, a first-degree relative with the condition, your risk is increased.
But do we have any idea, and I throw this out to Dr. Gandy as well, what triggers it? If it isn't just straight genetic and we have yet to find any real environmental connection, what would trigger this in somebody? If everybody at the age of 80 started showing signs of Alzheimer's, well, then we would understand that this is a natural part of the aging process. But it only happens to some people.
Well, the prevalence is shockingly high. There are some studies that suggest that after age 85, it's as high as 50%. So whatever the trigger is, it is fairly ubiquitous. But we usually don't understand what the trigger is. Work that Dr. Mayu and his team have done have illustrated the role of head injury in some risk for Alzheimer's disease.
But trauma really can do it?
Well, in people who are predisposed, and Richard can talk about this in more detail, the head trauma can initiate the process and get the entire process going. We studied, for example, a group of boxers and found that in boxers with a certain type of genetic makeup were much more predisposed to develop a dementia as a consequence of their boxing than if they had more protective genes.
I'm surprised. I'd always heard that that sort of thing could lead to epilepsy, head trauma. But is there a connection between epilepsy and Alzheimer's?
Well, there is a higher frequency of seizures in people with Alzheimer's disease. In fact, in the mutation variety that Dr. Gandy mentioned earlier, people with presenilin mutations who get Alzheimer's disease, they frequently have seizures, but it's not because of a head injury. The trauma itself causes an expression of amyloid beta, and the later in life that you have closed head injury, at least in some studies, it suggests that you may not be able to process this amyloid that's expressed.
Let's take another call. This one is from Michelle from Tappan. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I'm a 38-year-old mother with a lot going on during the day, and I feel like I have a terrible memory. I mean, I don't remember things in my childhood. I heard you earlier saying that this is a short-term memory problem, and if you think you have a short-term memory issue, then you should, I don't know, is there something I should do to get myself checked out? Is there something I can do to prevent this? I mean, I don't know if, you know, this is a problem yet or not. I don't know if you can talk to that at all.
Yes. Generally speaking, people who are busy, especially, you know, working mothers, people who have a lot on their plate, it's very hard to remember things on a regular basis. The characteristics of Alzheimer's disease, though, are immediate memory. In fact, many patients with Alzheimer's disease can remember things about their childhood, but they can't remember what day it is.
But isn't that something that happens to many old people without having Alzheimer's? I've had the experience of somebody who I had a very nice conversation with not remembering me later that day, and then meeting him at a party the next year, and he was very warm and talked about what a terrific time we'd had together.
It's when it's persistent. All of us forget the name of someone we just met, or maybe even forget an appointment. But when it happens in a repetitive fashion, I think that's when it starts to be.
Is that
a problem
for you, Michelle?
That's not quite the problem. It's just I feel like my long-term memory is lacking, and I've been feeling like this for a long time. And everybody is always saying, you know, you're working, you're a mother, you have a lot on your plate. It's normal. And I don't know if it is normal or not. And I don't know if this is worrisome for later. You know, some people say you could pick up, you know,
But Dr. Mayo, you're saying that this is not something that would be Alzheimer's. It may be something, but it would not be connected to
Alzheimer's. My guess is related to the stress and, you know, some that sort of thing.
My guests are Dr. Richard Mayo, Gertrude H. Sergevsky, professor of neurology, psychiatry, and epidemiology, and the co-director of the Taub Institute of Research on Alzheimer's Disease and the Aging Brain at Columbia University Medical College, and Dr. Samuel Gandy, professor of neurology and psychiatry, associate director of the Mount Sinai Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, chair of the National Medical National Medical and Scientific Advisory Council of the Alzheimer's Association, obviously two of the leading researchers into the condition. By the way, at the end of this hour, we will be bringing you live President Bush's remarks on the House's passage of the Economic Rescue Plan. You'll want to stay tuned for that as well. But we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And let's go to Wendy from Stanford. Hi.
Hi. My mother was diagnosed at age 57 with Alzheimer's, and it was, in fact, seizures that tipped us off that it was that and not maybe some sort of depression. And I was wondering, soon after she was diagnosed, I remembered that I saw some documentary where they said that there's a component of early Alzheimer's that is genetic and that it has a huge impact on offspring, like 50% of offspring would get it or had a chance of 50% of getting it. And I was wondering what percentage of early onset Alzheimer's is that genetic component that's so devastating? And I can take my answer off.
Okay, thank you for calling. Dr. Gandy?
Well, certainly the genetic forms tend to be early onset, but there also can be early onset that's not related to an identifiable genetic component. Are there other members of your family in previous generations, or brothers and sisters of your mother that had had Alzheimer's disease?
Well, she said she was hanging up, but are there biomarkers that we can check out and find out? For example, now that the human genome can be examined in great detail, can we spot things that would suggest that there was Alzheimer's in the offing?
Well, for the genetic forms, we can sequence the gene and actually find the mistakes essentially from the moment of conception, like other genetic diseases. So for those rare forms, we can predict perfectly. We can diagnose perfectly and predict perfectly who has those. But those are only a couple of percent of the entire picture. For the others, we're looking for biological markers, such as the ones Dr. Mayhew mentioned, not only looking for this amyloid material that clumps and can be found in the bloodstream, as he has studied, but we can now visualize amyloid clumps building up in the brain. We've been developing new brain scans that actually enable us to visualize amyloid buildup in the brain during life.
Now, we have just a few moments before we are going to go to President Bush's speech, but I do want to find out, are there drugs that have been developed? Is diet a factor? Can we improve our chances by eating certain things and not eating certain things? Dr.
Well,
Mayhew?
The best thing that's happened over the past few years is that using this genetic information, people like Dr. Gandhi and others have developed a group of drugs that actually attack the buildup of the protein and either prevent it from occurring or break it up into smaller parts.
It folds, doesn't it?
It does. And these types of drugs are probably going to revolutionize the way we treat this disease. They're not ready to be prescribed yet, but they're moving along through the various stages for FDA approval.
So we're doing clinical trials right now.
Right, and we're all very optimistic. In terms of whether you can modify it by diet, there's really not a lot of evidence that you can prevent it with diet, although I think everyone agrees that whatever you would do for your heart would also be good for your brain. So exercise and a well-planned diet are good maneuvers to prevent the disease.
Anything you want to add to that, Dr. Gandhi, as the developer of the hopeful medication?
Well, again, in terms of what we can do now, as Dr. Mayhew mentioned, in addition to the dietary factors that are good for your heart, controlling blood pressure, controlling body weight, controlling blood sugar, all of these things that we associate with heart disease seem also to be risks for Alzheimer's disease.
Many people are concerned about buildup of metals in the body. Is that something that we see connected to Alzheimer's?
Well, I don't think that there's been a consistent study that shows it. And I know that there are places where you can get chelated and things like that, but I don't think any of us believe that that's the root of the problem.
We've gotten a lot of calls from people who have Alzheimer's in the family, including somebody who is one of three children. The other two have gotten it. Mm. That would suggest that there is a genetic component in that family.
That's right. That's correct.
Meanwhile, when you find out something like that, is there anything you can do?
Well, not at this point. However, I think that
other than assume that it doesn't have to hit all three.
It doesn't have to hit all three. Genetic counseling and to sort of estimate your true risk is a very good plan. But I imagine as the newer drugs come around, a genetic analysis will be a deciding factor as to maybe what type of therapy you enter into.
Now, the people with the Alzheimer's are not the only victims of this illness. The family members are as well. In the brief time that we have left, is there any advice that you can give people who don't want to just send somebody off to a senior citizen home, who want to try at least for a time to work with a loved one who has Alzheimer's? Dr. Gandhi?
Well, the Alzheimer's Association and its local chapters was really founded on support for caregivers, and it's very important that caregivers reach out to others in similar situations and to healthcare professionals to help cope with this, because virtually no one can cope with this. Managing a loved one at home alone, it requires substantial resources for an extended period of time, 8 to 10 years usually.
So is it foolhardy to assume that you can do it by yourself?
No, I don't think it's foolhardy. It's just that it's important for the caregiver not to exhaust himself or herself. That's often what we see, that as a disease of involving both people, the caregiver often develops what we call burnout and has an increased incidence of depression. They develop flus and other diseases more frequently because they just seem to be beaten down and burned down by caring for the person with the disease.
And you want to add something, Dr. May?
Yes, I was just going to say, what we often hear is the spouse comes in and says, you know, when I go to work, I can rest. So they're at home taking care of their loved one all the time, and then when they go to work, they find it's easier and more relaxing.
Is there anything that you're looking for right now in your research?
Well, we're still, I run a study that's a national study, including Mount Sinai, that are trying to identify families in which there are two or three family members with Alzheimer's disease, and the goal is to identify the genes. This is part of a National Institute of Health study. We evaluate families and then pool the data and share it with all scientists across the nation and the world to try to pinpoint all the genes related to Alzheimer's disease. And they're very similar studies on drugs and various aspects of Alzheimer's disease.
Kim, hi, you're on the air. Kim is from the Upper East Side.
Hi, I actually have like a twofold question. Number one, my mom is on Aricept right now. She only takes like 5 milligrams. The one problem is she forgets to take the pill. And the second one is she's actually starting to get a little bit more forgetful or asking the same questions repetitively. How high can the dosage go? And you can go up to 10 or 15? I mean, the doctor just said we'll start you at 5. So any comments on that?
Well, it's hard to diagnose over the phone, obviously. But can you just keep on increasing the dosage?
No. The top dosage of Aricept is 10 milligrams. I would recommend before you do anything that you go back to your physician and tell them just what you've told us. There are additional medications that can be added, but I certainly would highly recommend that you go back to your primary physician before you make any adjustments.
Okay, Kim?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Marta from Dumont, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
My mother has Alzheimer's, and I think she was diagnosed, she started her mental decline after my brother was killed about 15 years ago. I also had a son that I lost in a car accident, and I'm starting to feel my mental decline too. I have been going to a neurologist that put me in Aricept.
But wait, can we stop for a second? Both doctors have suggested that sometimes depression is diagnosed as Alzheimer's. And have you tried to find out whether it might just be depression? After all, you're going through a rough time.
I don't suffer from depression. I don't know if my mother did at the time. But my question to you, I also volunteered to a research at the New York Psychiatrist Institute in New York City for a study that they're conducting to predict who's likely to develop Alzheimer's later on in life.
We have 10 seconds. Could anybody talk about this?
Well, I think that one would have to evaluate you in person. I have to see how the depression plays in and whether that's a role, and also just see how you're responding to the medication.
And we thank our doctors, Dr. Richard Mayhew of Columbia University Medical College and Dr. Samuel Gandhi of Mount Sinai School of Medicine.